Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Lita Judge. She's a prolific author and illustrator of several award-winning picture books for young people. We're talking about her latest, The Wisdom of Trees, How Trees Work Together to Form a Natural Kingdom. Lita, welcome back. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
Last time we talked, you had done an adult work called Mary's Monster, which was absolutely wonderful. And it was only when I was contacted to cover this that I realized you're this prolific young people's book author and illustrator. And we'll talk about some of your other works in a bit. But I am so glad you did this about the wisdom of trees, because this is really some of the latest research that they found out about trees. Talk to me about how you got turned on to it.
Oh, it's such an exciting time to write about this topic, because you're right. It is the very latest research that's happening. And the way I decided to write this book is I was actually hiking in England, and long ago I was a geologist and was working in that field and had taken a trip with my husband to England for hiking. And actually, in hindsight, I realized I was doing a lot of soul searching about wanting to really embark on this journey of being an author and an illustrator. And we were hiking in some backcountry of the Cotswolds, and the clouds opened up and it was pouring rain, and we were sitting under an oak tree that was about 1,500 years old.
Wow.
The girth of this tree, it takes like 12 people to stand hand to hand to, you know, encompass this tree. It's just this massive, beautiful organism. And, you know, we were finding shelter under this tree, but I was just feeling like I was at a crossroads. It was time to make a change in my life. And sitting under that tree, I decided to go home and write my first children's book. And I did, and it got published, and everything kind of changed in my life. And I think this is my 30th book. So so I have a fondness for this tree, I should say. And I promised myself if I got my first book published, I would go back and say thank you to the tree. And so we did. And then I promised myself if every fifth book that I published, I would go back and say thank you to the tree. So I've written 30. So that's a lot of trips to this tree. And the last time when we were hiking, I started to be worried about whether I'd see the tree, because there had been some recent development in the area, and I saw these massive oaks being cut down. And I had also been reading scientific papers about this cunning research about mycorrhizal fungi connecting trees and the world wood web and how trees communicate and work as these organisms together. And I was just so bowled over by this. And in visiting the tree again, I realized it was time for their story, that was kind of more interesting than any story I could invent at the time. And it was time to write this book. So it's kind of a song of gratitude, I guess you could say, to this incredible tree and all the trees that I've met along the way.
This book is particularly information heavy, content heavy, which is really interesting. There's poems on the left that you wrote. On the right side is some of the more technical information. And then in the back of the book, there's even more information. So it's a scientific book, but it's done in a way that's very appealing to young people, and actually appealing, I have to say this, to older people too. Now, people who don't know what we're talking about, it is totally weird that they've found that trees can instant message. Talk about that.
Yeah, trees are, above ground, they look like individuals, but underneath...
You would never suspect this.
Yeah, I know. It's just mind-blowing. What's mind-blowing is that it's taken us to just the last 20 years to find this out. I mean, it's incredible that this communication has been going on for centuries and centuries, and we are completely unaware because we don't speak tree and don't understand their language. But they have a secret language. It's silent. It's based on these mycorrhizal fungi that live in their roots, and the fungi break down the soil and break down nutrients for the tree. In exchange, the tree gives them nutrition. So they live in this symbiotic relationship. And through these fungi, the tree can send electrical pulses to its neighboring tree. So they don't speak, the way we speak, but they do speak. They, if a tree is damaged in a storm or a disease, it will send out notes of hunger to its neighboring trees, and the trees will respond. And this goes across species divides. It's such an incredible model of how a community can work together. And we're really realizing that this mycorrhizal fungi that functions below the earth is just what connects these massive forests. And it enables trees to live their full lifetime. When a tree is planted in a yard without this connection to mycorrhizal fungi, they tend to live half their lifetime.
Wow.
So it's just incredible what we're learning now that we've learned to look at the right, you know, write things and understand how this communication is being passed and forth.
Before we go on, what age group is this book for?
Oh, you know, I try to write. The reason I wrote it in poems and sidebars is because I thought the information was just so incredibly fascinating. I wanted to bring in as many ages as possible. And so I kind of call it a layered text.
Yep.
The poems
yep.
are written for very young children to introduce the concepts. And the art, too. You know, I always think of, I love writing visual books because I feel like we are all visual learners long before we're literate. So with the poetry and the art, a very young reader can take this and then have a conversation with an older reader about these concepts. But then third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, these sidebars offer more of the scientifical technical information. So it's a description on the same page that illuminates the concept that the poem has introduced. So this concept of mycorrhizal fungi, you know, what is it? How does it work? What's going on between the trees? That's all explained in the sidebar. And then in the end, there's even deeper, richer material
yep.
about the locations of these trees and the diversity of the trees and really cool facts about, you know, how we know how old trees are and all the different fascinating topics that are coming to light because of these incredible forest ecologists. So it's kind of, and that's, I think, where adults have, I've been really excited by the response from adults because this information is new, and a few people have written an adult book about it, but this is kind of brings it in a lovely way to introduce this concept of what trees are actually doing.
Not only are trees fascinating, I think fungi are really weird.
Yeah, they are pretty amazing.
Because a lot of people may think that fungi are plants. They're not.
Yeah, they're more closely related to animals.
Isn't
than
that
plants,
weird?
Which is mind-blowing. And it's also mind-blowing how big they are. And I remember, I think it's in the back matter, there's a honey fungi that's mentioned. And I remember seeing that when I was a kid because it's in Eastern Oregon, and I spent time in Eastern Oregon. And this fungi lives under the ground, but it has, like, surface outcroppings. And it's literally, I think it's 7,500 tons it weighs,
Jesus.
Covers 4 square miles. I mean, in this case, it's not a healthy mycorrhizal fungi, which helps the trees. It actually, a lot of fungi live on the wood of a deceased tree, but they're truly incredible. And one of them, they are the most diverse organism on the planet.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And so many of us have spent so little time really looking at them, and yet the function of the planet kind of runs with them.
I love the way that you taught children how to pronounce mycorrhizal. And that's going to be forever stuck in my mind. It's like the Irishman, you know, fungologist, mycorrhizal.
I wish you could hear the debate between my editor and I about how we should spell that out. Because
that was great.
Parts of the world.
No, that was great.
Interpreting that.
And this book does have a global perspective. You talk about the acacias in Africa, and you talk about trees in British Columbia and Germany and Brazil and Malaysia. It really does have a global perspective.
I really wanted to offer that global perspective because, you know, we've become, our fates are entwined together. We are a global society now. Our climate is controlled by everybody, and the help, if we're going to help this injured planet, we need to work together. And the other reason is because I wanted to talk about, the last poem of the book talks about diversity of a forest and how only with diversity can we have a healthy forest. And without that, they're subjected to disease and widespread fire and damage. And so I wanted to not just have a North American perspective on that, and to sample from different trees from different parts of the world and kind of get a more of a full picture on that.
Now, let me talk to you as an artist. Was it a learning curve for you to learn how to paint forests or trees? Because for many artists, that's a challenge.
It is a challenge. challenge. I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's sometimes underestimated by non-painters how hard it is to paint a tree.
Yep.
And it's interesting, when this book came out, I had a few people ask me to send them a how-to to paint a tree. And it was so hard to just not, my answer felt like saying, well, take a journal, go out into the forest and spend half of your life drawing trees and maybe you'll come up with the answers. I mean, it's such an art of observation because every tree is not the same.
Every tree is complicated. I mean, just a tree.
Yes.
Just a deciduous tree is like, depending upon the species, it's like there's all this craziness about the bark and then the roots. And then there's these patches of leaves catching light every way. And it's amazingly difficult. And people don't understand that.
Yeah, I mean, is it a young tree or an old tree?
Yeah,
is it winter?
Yeah.
Is it spring? Is the light streaming through and backlit? I mean, it's just incredible. And I really actually, I'm thankful for my experience as a geologist, because geology is a science of observation. You're just running around mapping the world and looking for these obscure little clues that paint a picture of how the Earth was formed. And I really think also I was raised with two ornithologists for grandparents, and they sent us out in the field early in the wee hours of the morning every day to band hawks and to record observations in nature. And I really realized that was my art school. That was where I learned to observe. So when people ask me how to draw a tree, I don't know the answer. All I know is look, just look and look and look, and then learn to simplify too, because that was one of the biggest challenges is
right.
If you're painting
right.
this 300-foot-tall majestic tree and I'm putting it on paper, you do have to make some decisions of editing. But how do you honor that tree and that specific tree and capture that character while making an interpretation for your reader? So it was a really fun challenge. And a lot of my books have been very character-oriented.
Yep.
I tend to focus on that. So this was, I was definitely out of my comfort zone for this one.
But you did a beautiful job. Are you using watercolors?
I do. I use very traditional methods. When I was a geologist, I would run around with a journal painting out in the field, and I just really love that immediacy. And a lot of children's books are switching over to digital art, and there's a lot of merit to digital art. It's, for one thing, it's faster, and you know, the deadline of publishing can be a tempting media. There's things you can do with digital that you can't do with traditional. But I really wanted. I like the tradition of the media. I like the immediacy of it. I kind of like the fact that it feels like you're walking on a tightrope. You know, if you screw up, there's no going back. There's no just hit the delete button. It's kind of a recording of what you were feeling when you were doing the painting. And I thought, particularly for this book, it really had to be that traditional watercolor medium too, because I'm trying to paint the trees pretty realistically and, you know, not in a stylized way. I wanted the trees to really have a voice, because this whole book is about the fact that trees communicate and they have a language that we as humans are only recently learning to understand. And so I didn't want to get an art style that was in the way of that. I wanted to have the art really reflect the natural beauty of the trees themselves. And so watercolors just made the most sense for me.
But also aesthetically, watercolors.
Yeah.
There's a subtlety to a lot of the colors and the way that they blend together, and then the way that you work them on the paper. There's really a quality about watercolor that cannot be duplicated digitally.
Absolutely. It's such a richness. And I think for that reason, I'll never give up this medium.
Good for you.
It's I just feel as an artist, it's wonderful to be part of that, you know, beautiful, rich medium. And sometimes I'm working on final art for a book right now, and I think one painting I've done five times over, because they're tricky. Yeah, they can have a way of their own. But if you learn to wrangle them, I think also they can be so incredibly beautiful.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Lita Judge. She is a prolific author and illustrator of many children's books, picture books for young people. And we're talking about her latest, The Wisdom of Trees, How Trees Work Together to Form a Natural Kingdom. I mean, I knew some of this research, but I have to say that your book actually turned me on to some really interesting specifics. Like, you write about birches helping furs.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, that I think was the most mind-blowing fact for me. As a naturalist growing up, you're kind of aware, you know, when you dig through the ground into the roots of a tree, you see the fungi and you see things going on, and you get the fact that they're somewhat connected, but not to the degree of this fact that they're actually sending out alert signals and distress signals to one another. And then to find out that that it crosses species. I mean, there's this incredible research ecologist, Suzanne Simon, in Canada, who literally performed experiments. She was seeing small Douglas fir saplings kind of wasting away because they had been planted in an artificial setting in a forestry plot, and it was just one species, and they weren't doing well. And then she found that the saplings that were near paper birch were thriving, and they, through experiments, were realizing that the saplings were sending out signals to the nearby paper birch, and the paper birch were responding by giving them sugars from their own bodies, which is just mind-blowing, I mean, in terms of the implications to what, for our own culture and our own societies, about how the well-being of all matters, and that we're all healthier if we care for our neighbors.
I think even if you're a natural historian within the last 50 years, you tend to look at trees as everything for themselves. That's it. It's like they're like a forest is just a bunch of individuals who aren't really helping each other. As a matter of fact, they're depending upon other trees to die out so they can flourish. And and this is a whole... this is a whole reversal of that attitude.
Yeah, I remember as I was a kid, you know, the thing you always heard, the phrase you always heard about the natural world is survival of the fittest. And it's just not true. It's survival of the all. I mean, they do their darndest to make sure that all can survive. So, yeah, I think I'm the most grateful for learning that. When, every time I do a book, you know, I feel like I've been enriched by the content. And this
absolutely
particularly has really changed, you know, my outlook on life and how I see the world.
There's some amazing parts of this book. First of all, you trace the journey of a tree, you know, through the seasons. But then as they get older, one of the things that a lot I know has always fascinated me is about measuring the growth of a tree. And for people who don't know, talk about how you do that.
Yeah, I mean, the most apparent obvious is when you're walking in the woods, if you see a tree that's been cut and you see a cross-section of the stump, there's rings, light and dark rings. And those are the different layers of the tree. The Cambrian is right under the bark, and every new year it puts on new growth. And the result is that you get these growth rings. And so you can count either the light rings or the dark rings, but the pear represents the growth for that season. And so a 100-year-old tree would have 100 light and dark rings, and a 300-year-old tree would have 300 rings.
And there's some incredibly ancient trees in your book.
Oh, man. And I got to visit some of them, which was amazing. Because if I'm going to illustrate these trees, you know, living here in New Hampshire, I'm fortunate to have some mature trees around me, but not ancient. So, you know, we traveled to see bristlecone pines that are 4,500 years old.
Can you imagine?
Traveled to,
God.
The world that they witnessed. I mean, we got to go to Wales, and I had little maps of, like, these ancient trees that have been recorded. And, you know, dodging around the back roads of Wales, sometimes the GPS says you arrived and you're in a pasture with sheep, and you're like, where is this tree? But eventually, you know, we found these incredible yews that were estimated to be 4,000 years old. And they're so huge that you feel like, at first, you think you haven't found them, and then you realize you're standing in the middle of the tree, because these trees hollow out in time. They grow particularly where the core of them will rot out, but the outside stays intact. And I was sitting and sketching what, you know, from the naked eye, it first appears to be several scraggly yews, and you realize, oh my gosh, I'm standing in the heart of this tree, and it's just one ancient tree. And one of the particular trees I had sat in, had witnessed, it was where Henry VIII used to court Anne Boleyn. And another tree was where Cromwell had hid when his army, you know, during the Civil War. I mean, the history that these trees have witnessed is just mind-boggling.
That one with Henry VIII, that tree has a name, Anchorwick?
Yeah.
That's like something out of Tolkien.
I know, it's so wonderful. And that tree, everybody can see. You don't have to bobble around in the sheep pastures. It's lost because it's, you know, it's close to London. So it's a wonderful tree to go visit.
But even when trees die and pass on, they're important. And talk about why.
Oh, my gosh. That was one of my favorite facts about the tree, too. That this concept that even after they die, the trees surrounding them will feed their root systems. And in some cases, like with birch, you will walk into the forest, and then some areas where ancient forests have been allowed to grow, you see these circles of they look like moss-covered stones, but they're actually the roots of these ancient trees still living on because the neighboring trees are feeding it. But then long after their bodies are gone and they're producing root sugars for the community, they end up decaying, and the material from their bodies goes into feeding the next generation. And it's this beautiful cycle of life.
Now, can I get you to read one or two of the poems in the book?
Sure. Actually, why don't I read that poem, since we just talked about that concept. It's called We Are the Ghosts. My limbs and needles are gone, and the warm body of a newborn deer comes to rest within the ghost of my great trunk that once touched the sky. But underneath the soft litter of fallen needles and dark soil, I still live, surrounded by my kingdom with a willingness to give. And the kingdom refers to, the first poem talks about a kingdom of trees, that no one tree is an individual, that it lives within a kingdom.
Did you always write poetry?
You know, when I was a kid, I was so sure I wasn't a writer because I was dyslexic, and I grew up in a really remote part of the country, so I didn't have a lot of access to books. If you'd asked me if I was going to be a writer, I would have just looked at you with panic. But I realize now I actually have always written poetry. I carried a journal with me, and I recorded what I saw, and I wrote what I wrote, and I just kind of followed my heart. And, you know, years later, you find the craft of it. But I love to tell young children, you know, what matters is that you observe and that you have something to say. And so definitely as a youngster, I had something to say and I was observing. And so I was creating, you know, as soon as I could hold a pencil. I realized it was in my bloodstream. It just took me many years of, you know, first being a geologist and then being a painter before I finally realized that I needed to put words to a page.
Wow.
In order for my art to feel complete.
Now, as you get to the back parts of the book, you present the challenges ahead. And there's some pretty sobering facts in this. We've lost 46% of the world's trees.
Yeah. Yeah. Two trees per person per year. Yeah.
But there are things that you can do. The most important thing, especially with young people, is there are things you can do. And one of them, basic things, is just to cut down on paper use.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many things, and I think it can feel, you know, overburdening and daunting in terms of can you make a difference? But you actually can make a difference. And I know in my own practices, you know, I feel that's the one heartache I have is my medium takes resources to create. I used to paint in oils, and I gave them up because of the toxins. It's another reason why I love watercolors. And then when I work with paper, I don't buy the expensive thick paper. I use, you know, paper that's thinner, and I used to have a stash of recycled paper like anybody, you know, when it was convenient, I used it. But now I actually draw an entire book on the side of one piece of paper, and then the next book is on the back side of that paper. And I've actually found, in the beginning, it felt like a distraction, and now it actually feels like kind of a rite of passage. One story kind of hands over to the next story. So I'm working on a book now that's very young and whimsical, and it's on the back of many of the tree sketches, and it kind of keeps me connected.
Oh, wow, good for you. Good for you. Now, you have another book coming out soon, Even the Smallest Will Grow?
Yes. Yeah, it's very different from trees. I like to go back and forth between books that require a lot of research and then also books that are kind of just inspired from like an emotional place in my life that I feel like, you know, when I have a thought that kind of connects to what I think a young reader is going through. In this case, the book is kind of a soft lullaby to a very young child about growing up. And when you're very little, I remember it and I see it because I visit a lot of schools, that it can be a time of frustration. There's a lot of things you can't do or told you can't do. But it can also be such a rich and beautiful time because every day, literally, you're changing and you're able to do things you couldn't do the day before. And I wanted this book to just be a celebration of all the potential a young child holds in their hearts and all the things that they will eventually grow into. And so, and it's written in a, in kind of a lullaby tone. It, you know, it's meant to be a book of comfort and a book of joy. I often am asked about writing for really young children because a lot of people know me through my, you know, like the Book of Trees. I kind of draw from my scientific background, but I really love to create books that also have like an emotional potency for really young readers. And because I'm a visual artist, I love to be part of that pre-literate world where you're really bringing the world of literature to young children.
Is that like the Red Sled?
Yeah, that, the Red Sled actually was kind of my nod to the fact that, you know, when I was a kid, I was dyslexic and I grew up in a pretty remote area of the country. And then when I started entering school, I could tell I was a smart kid and things clicked for me, except reading. It was a mystery why reading seemed to make more sense to other people. And it was years before I realized I just have a brain that's hardwired in an incredibly different way. And I realize now for every disadvantage I had for reading, I had a huge advantage in terms of my visual memory.
That's right. That's exactly what they found out.
Yeah, I have this spatial thing. So I wanted to write a book for not only pre-literate kids, but kids like me, because the first book I ever saw was written in a foreign language, but it was illustrated. And that book just lit up the lights for me that I love story. And I'm also, it gave me confidence. I realized I'm smart. I just read differently. So,
Lita, we're completely out of time. This is a wonderful, this is an amazing book. My returning guest tonight is Lita Judge. She's a prolific author and illustrator of young people's picture books and science books, too. And we're talking about her latest. It is a good book. The Wisdom of Trees, How Trees Work Together to Form a Natural Kingdom. I recommend it highly, even if you're an adult. Lita, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.